not a con.
My name is Rick Wash, and I'm currently a PhD student at the University of Michigan. And today I'm going to talk about and kind of a current emerging field in a research field right now called the economics of security, or the economics of malevolence in cyberspace. And this field kind of studies what makes people do things in security. So why do products sell or don't sell? Why would people want to hack? Things like that are all valid game for this research field. And what I'm covering today is kind of an overview of some of the interesting recent results. And the field is only about 3 years old at the moment, so this pretty much covers most of the interesting results. But it should be a good primer and kind of give you a clue of what a lot of the current researchers are thinking about right now. So, in particular, I'm going to talk about two sub-areas. One is kind of the theory of security, the economics of security in particular, and how things put together and why. And the second one is what happens when you put these theories into practice, what do we see out in the real world? So to start with, I want to start with a paper from a well-known economist named Halvarian, who tried to model just the basic security situation. So imagine we have two people, X and Y, X1 and X2. These people are trying to put forth some effort to get something done. And whether they get it done is some function f of their total effort. So you combine these two efforts in some way to get the total effort, and then this is the value they get if they get it done. And then each of them has their own cost for putting forth effort. So putting forth effort is more costly, but it might pay out. So this is the basic model we have. And then there's four different ways of effort. What happens if the total effort is what matters? So if you and I work together, the total amount of our effort is what determines our total payout. The next one is a best shot case. What happens if only the person who puts the highest forth effort, that's what determines the amount of profit we make. And nothing below that actually matters. There's the weakest link case, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with, of what about the minimum effort? If you have two pieces of security technology, the weakest link is all it needs to go through to break through frequently. And finally, the more explicit model of an adversary, of saying the adversary is the Y guy in this case, and he's working directly against this defender of the X guy. So if he puts forth more effort than the X guy, then F is negative. And some results from this. First of all, in the total effort case, reliability is determined by the agent with the highest benefit-to-cost ratio. All the others free ride. So in this case, in the model, you end up with whoever's got the most benefits per cost. So if I get more benefit, then if I put forth a little bit more effort and you put forth a little bit more effort, but I get more benefit out of that, then, which basically means I have a lower cost of putting forth effort, then I'm going to put forth all of the effort, and you're going to slack off and do nothing, which in economic speak is called free ride. And it turns out that in this case, that's actually too little effort. Ideally, you want both people putting forth some effort, and you'd have a little bit more effort total than what people are individually incentivized to do. So this is a dichotomy between what the individuals would choose and what the group should choose. In the best shot case, it turns out that the guy with the lowest benefit-to-cost ratio is the one that determines the total amount of effort. All the others put forth the exact same amount of effort as the guy with the lowest benefit-to-cost ratio. And it turns out this is as good as the group can do, which is a nice result. In the weakest link case, the reliability is determined by the guy with the highest benefit-to-cost ratio. All the others free ride. But in this case, too much work is actually exerted. If the group as a whole would choose, they would actually choose less because someone else would be doing it, because someone else with a lower benefit-to-cost ratio would be working. Finally, in the adversarial case, you get some very interesting results. What really matters is how the cost-benefit ratio of the defender compares to that of the attacker, like in the other three results. And it turns out if the cost-benefit ratio is lower, the attacker gives up, and the defender does just enough security to keep him from attacking him. However, if the cost-benefit ratio is higher, then the defender works his ass off, and the attacker keeps doing as much security as he can to make sure he's going to have to work hard to get in. So, and you actually kind of see this in the real world. If they're actually going to get in, you'd be working really hard. But if you're a mom and pop, they're not going to attack because your benefit to cost ratio is lower, or their benefits are less because you're not worth very much, then you end up doing just enough to keep them away. So this is a very simple model that turns out to have very interesting intuitive results in the real world. And one of the main reasons I included this is to kind of show no one in this room seemed to me, when I looked around, flinched when I gave the definition of adversary as the guy who's working exactly opposite goal of you. And this is the normal definition of adversary when we do security. He's the guy who wants to get into my thing. I want to stop him. It's the exact opposite goals. And this is actually the only paper that I know of that actually has that. In economics, they tend to model people as self-interested agents. And what that means is everyone's out for their own good. I want to get as much money as possible. Cameron wants to get as much money as possible. When that happens, when you understand people that way, you get a lot more insight into why they might be attacking you. And that turns out to be very important to understanding why things happen. If someone's trying to get to your database, it's not because they don't like you. It's because they want to profit on their own. Sometimes there is this adversarial relationship. A lot of denial of services or defacements, for example, have that property. But in general, it's because people want something of their own. It's not because they don't like you and are specifically working against you. You just happen to be the one that has what they want. So another example I'm going to go into is some theory about how much should security cost. And it turns out there's some interesting results from the economics literature that apply here really well. In the first case, this is the concept of an externality. And think about when I'm blasting my stereo, when we had all this music down here last night. This was really loud, and it quite possibly annoyed some people. However, when I was deciding how loud to play it, I didn't take all those people I'd annoy into account. So this is an example of an externality, because I didn't take their interest into account when I was making my decision. Classic example from economics is the pollution. If I'm a company producing something, I produce lots of pollution, I don't take into account everyone else's discomfort from the pollution. I just take into account my profits. If I can do better by polluting more, then I will, regardless of the fact that everyone else suffers. So this is the definition of what an externality is, of not taking it into account. And there's two major solutions that economics usually uses, and what they do is they try to force people to take these things into account. The first one is a tax. If I'm going to pollute, the government can tax me to try to make sure I don't pollute near as much. And the goal would be to set the tax just high enough that I pollute at the correct level instead of polluting at a much higher level. And second is property rights. This one is much more interesting. It says that if you assign rights to someone on one of the two things, so for a stereo example, you assign the rights to the audio, the noise pollution, the airwaves, to one of the two people, and then they can, so if there's too much noise here and the guys upstairs have rights, then they can sue you and collect money for your polluting the air, and then that will cause them to reduce it down to the optimal level. Same thing with pollution. And a great theorem, which has actually won a Nobel Prize a number of years ago, is from a guy named Ron Coase, and he says, if transactions costs are low, assigning property rights will achieve the social optimum level of the externality. So if you assign property rights to the polluted air or the polluted lakes, then the people who have those rights can sue the polluters, and it turned out that you'll get the socially best level of pollution, where you balance the harm that's being caused to the environment with the good that's being caused by someone actually making something. Furthermore, when the costs are low, it doesn't matter who you assign the rights to. Whoever you assign the rights to, the other person will start negotiating. And as long as the cost of negotiating is low, then it can work out quite well. Security is a great example of an externality. Think, for example, of the compromised machines that are used as zombies to attack others, like the eBay and Yahoo denial of services that happened a number of years ago. So in this case, when I was deciding how much to secure my machine if it was used in this attack, I didn't take into account the possible harm that could be caused on eBay and Yahoo. So this is a great example of an externality. Firms don't incorporate all those possible other uses against other people. Because I was because I and a million other people were insecure, eBay and Yahoo had security problems. If we were secure, then they would have been fine. So this is a great example of an externality. And this, in general, this results on an underspending on security from a social welfare perspective. Too little money is spent on security, which I'm sure if anyone has actually been in the room trying to make security decisions along this line can probably agree with. So one possible solution would be to assign property rights in security. So when Yahoo was attacked, they could sue the people that were used as zombies. That didn't happen, and that's because there's a number of reasons this doesn't work. First of all, enforcement costs. Trying to find everyone who attacked Yahoo and suing them would cost much more than they lost from those attacks. Trying to sue 2 million people is just not really practical. And finally, it's really easy to lie. If you want to do it before the attacks, I was going to hack you. Please pay me money. It's really easy to lie about things if you try to do it beforehand, and then the enforcement costs come in afterhand. So when that happens, property rights don't really work, because this is essentially when the transaction costs are high, and the theorem said when transaction costs are low. So this is a known problem in security right now, and there's a number of people that are working on trying to find ways to get around this. But it's how your security matters to other people. Another really interesting result from economics is called a market for lemons. This was actually another Nobel Prize winning idea. And imagine we have people buying used cars. I still didn't fix that slide, did I? Imagine we have people buying used cars. So on the left, we have someone trying to sell a number of used cars. They range in value somewhere between $100 and $1,000. And then we have a bunch of people trying to buy used cars. And their opinion of how much the car is worth ranges from $100 to $1,500. And in general, the buyer thinks that the car is worth about 1.5 times what the seller thinks it's worth. So if they both knew exactly what the car was and got to play with it, the buyer would think it's 1.5 times as much as the seller. So in this case, the average value for the seller is $550. The average value to the buyer is $800. Now, what happens if the seller actually... So in general, in this case, you have people buying cars because... think about a case when neither party knows what if the car is a lemon or not. They haven't spent time driving it around. It's sitting on a lot. You can look at it, but you can't play with it. In that case, the seller knows that the average car that looks like that is worth $550. So he's willing to sell it as long as he makes at least $550. The buyer looks at it and says, the average car like that's worth on average $800 to me. So he's willing to buy it as long as he doesn't have to pay more than $800. Well, there's a good range in there that they can agree on some kind of price, and they'll sell cars. Now what happens if the seller, all of a sudden, he owns the car to start with, so he goes out, drives it real quick. Oh, I now know how much it is. I know whether it's a lemon or it's a good car. So he knows whether it's a $200 car or an $800 car or a $1,000 car. Well, in this case, he knows no buyer is going to be willing to spend more than $800 because they don't know whether it's a good car, so they're just going to look for the average. But if I went and found out this was a really good car, it's actually worth $900 to the seller, that's more than any buyer is willing to pay. So the seller's not going to sell the top $200 worth of cars because no buyer is willing to pay enough for it. So they're only going to sell the bottom part. So the average drops down to $450. But now think about, what does the buyer know? Oh, the buyer knows that the seller went out and drove all those cars, and he's not going to sell me the top $200 worth of cars. So my cars are averaged between $100 and $1,200. So my average dropped again down to $650. So now the seller thinks, wait a second, no buyer's willing to buy a car more than $650. So his average drops again. And the buyer thinks that, wait, now he's not selling me cars that high anymore. So his goes down. And it turns out this is a classic example of what's called a market collapse. The whole market collapses, and all you see all you can buy is the lemons at the very bottom for $100. All the shitty cars where they both can agree they both suck. So what happens is the low-value sellers are the only ones that remain in the market, and all the high-value guys drop out because they can't sell. And an interesting result is this is a good example of the negative value of information. The buyers wish the sellers didn't have that information because then they could buy cars. But the sellers also wish they didn't have that information. It's actually better for the sellers not to have it because then they can sell the cars. When they do have the information, they can't. So then the classic example of what won the Nobel Prize is both identifying this and identifying this is why guarantees work really well. If you guarantee the cars are of a certain quality, then the buyer that gives the buyer some information and they're not completely in the dark, they might be willing to pay more than their original average. So the guarantee functions as a signal of quality. It's a kind of a guarantee that they're going to get at least as much money as they wanted. So if you think of security in this framework, security is an experience good. You really don't know how good your security product is until after you've used it, just like cars. It's not like I can walk around, everyone off, like my mom can walk around and look at security products and say, oh, that one looks good. How good is she going to get? However, vendors roughly know the quality of their security systems. They know whether they wrote it last night or they spent the last 3 years researching it. So they have some clue. It's not a strong, not an exact clue, but they have some clue. This sounds exactly like what the lemons market described. And it turns out if you look around, you see a lot of snake oil, a lot of bad products out in the market. How many times have you looked around and seen people have no clue what they're doing trying to sell security products? That happens a lot, and this is the theory of why this happens. And secondly, guarantees don't work, and this is for a couple reasons. First of all, security is actually, experience good isn't the right word for it. It's more an expert good. Even my mom, she buys a security product and uses it for a year, she's still not going to know how good it was. She really has no basis of comparison. You need to be an expert and have a clue. You need to be someone in this room to know whether a security product is good. So most users can't tell whether it's good, so they wouldn't know whether to collect on the guarantee or not if they get screwed. And secondly, they can't tell it even after they bought it. So this is why guarantees don't work, because they only work when you can tell whether you got a lemon after you buy it, but not before. And the general way to get around this right now is expert advice. See, right now you actually see two classes of security products. You see the one class of security products, which really sucks, and you see the one class of security products, which has expert names behind it. So you have snake oil, and you have like Counterpain that has Bruce Schneier touting it. You have most of the security products have some set of experts that are well-known experts that agree it's good. And a lot of the snake oil tries to make up their own experts because that's the way to sell it. The way you can trust it is find someone you trust, ask them if it's good. And that's the way you get around it. And that's why you have this strong dichotomy in the market right now for security products. So to try to get around some of the security problems, now we're moving on to what's called liability and insurance. It turns out security is a great case for liability and insurance as far as companies go. Companies have this big risk of they might get hacked. How do they handle this? So the first one comes from a lot of software has vulnerabilities in it. I'm sure everyone here knows that. So how do you give them the incentive to make less vulnerabilities in their software? So what happens if you made them liable? Everyone here has probably heard that. Let's make the vendors liable for any vulnerabilities in their system. Right now, that doesn't exist. You see explicit no liability clauses in almost every license agreement you ever find. And this is done to a little extent through reputation, like SendMail, no one uses it because back in the day, they had a huge security problem for like 2 years. So they had a big reputation hit. Microsoft, everyone knows their reputation in the security industry. It hasn't hurt them that much because they still sell a lot, and a lot of people don't understand it. So it does affect them to a little bit, but not much, and not near as much as it should. So introducing liability causes many practical issues. First of all, how do you assign liability to unforeseen classes of vulnerabilities? When a new total type of vulnerability comes out, are all those companies that had those vulnerabilities still liable for those bugs that they didn't know were even possible as security problems? Are they responsible for that? That's a big risk for companies to take, and that's going to discourage a lot of software vendors from getting in the business. So this huge risk is bad. And also, it's going to discourage the users from protecting themselves. If I don't have to worry, Microsoft screws up, they give me a huge lump sum of money, why the hell am I going to worry about protecting myself? So there's a lot of problems there on agency problems where you have users no longer trying to protect themselves because they just will take the money from the companies, and that is also bad because then you have tons of security on the internet. Tons of insecurity on the internet. So a better solution is to use insurance. So what you do is you go through and you buy insurance over getting hacked. So if I get hacked, I'm going to get paid from the insurance company, and if I don't, then I just pay out a small sum to the insurance. Everyone here probably has insurance, so they know how insurance works. You buy insurance from getting hacked. And what this allows to do is this ends up having many of the same effects that liability does. The insurance companies can basically they aggregate pressure from individual purchasers. You and I, when we go to Microsoft and say, make more secure software, they don't listen to us. However, if you have an insurance company that represents 2 million people, and they go to Microsoft and say, make more secure software, Microsoft can start listening. So you can aggregate pressure that way. The insurance companies can encourage and require users to protect themselves. They give discounts for more protection. Classic example is fire insurance. This place probably gets a huge discount on their fire insurance because they have smoke detectors. Actually, nowadays, they probably can't get insurance without smoke detectors. And finally, it centralizes risk. It puts all the risk into one place. So all of us don't have to take these huge risks on security. Risk is all at the insurance company. We're going to either not get hacked or get paid for getting hacked. So we're not as bad. Some of the problems why you don't see this right now, there's not enough data out there to quantify the risk. Insurance companies love data. That's their bread and butter. About security, we don't have it right now. This is a problem that's solvable, but we don't really have the data needed to quantify what is the risk in security. How much should we pay out when people get hacked? So you need a wide market base. Security doesn't work if only two people buy in. You need to get a lot of people to agree to buy security before anyone is willing to offer the security. Security attacks are hard to identify. A lot of problems, like what is the difference between a denial of service and a slashdot effect? One is considered a security problem. One is considered the cost of doing business, and a good thing in some cases. So one of them, if you're only getting insurance for security, one of them should pay out, one of them shouldn't. But the real difference is in the minds of the people doing it. There's no technical difference between the two, so it's very hard to tell. And finally, when something's stolen, like a credit card database, how do you value that loss? Because in general, if a hacker hacks in and steals my credit card database, I still have it. It's not like I lost anything. They have something extra now, and it's going to harm my reputation. But how do you really put a value on that? And is it the right value? So these are some practical issues with using insurance and security, but there's a number of people trying to work on solving these. So next, I'm going to move on to the economics of security in the real world. What happens when we look at security from an economic perspective in the real world? And the first thing I'm going to look at is vulnerability reporting. So in general, a number of researchers, specifically Eric Rescorla, came up with this interesting timeline for vulnerabilities. So you start out, everyone knows, bugs introduced sometime when software is being written. Some point in the future, someone in this room discovers that the vulnerability exists. And they tell the guy who wrote it. It's nice open source software. They send him an email and say, hey, you have a bug in your software. Sometime in the future after that, if it's open source, it's probably 2-3 hours. If it's Microsoft, it's probably 2-3 years. You end up with a patch released. So your patch fixes this security problem that was. Well, then there's a public announcement of this vulnerability. Sometimes those are opposite orders, but that's OK. At some point after the public announcement, you see lots of exploitation. People are exploiting it. There's a peak of exploitation. And way out in the future, no one's actually exploiting VAX machines anymore because you're not going to have any benefit from doing so. So in general, if you look at the amount of exploitation, it's very low at the beginning. There might be some hackers that discovered the bug in the very beginning. As soon as the patch is released, some people start reverse engineering and it goes up. When the public announcement happens, you get this sharp increase in the amount of people exploiting this bug. At some point it peaks and it slowly kind of trails off towards the end. This is generally how it works. And if you look at percentage of patched computers, before the patch is made, no one's patched. So you start patching here, you get a sharp increase when the public announcement's made, because all of us are good people and we patch our systems regularly. But not everyone does. So you start this tapering off effect, and very slowly until you get all the systems patched. And out here, it's not so much patching as being thrown in the garbage and being picked up by Amish One. So in general, this is what people think of as the timeline of a single vulnerability in the system. So we can use this model to help understand things. So when you think about vulnerabilities, you need to think about what are the decisions of the individual players. So why would you disclose vulnerability information? It helps the attackers. It tells them exactly what to do. You're drawing them a roadmap. A lot of times vulnerability information has attached with it exploit code. You're really giving them the script they need to run to hack you and everyone else. However, it also aids the defenders. It helps a lot in understanding the quality and security of software. No one uses sendmail anymore because everyone realized how insecure it was when all those vulnerabilities came out. It's very useful for research and teaching material. It's how all of us got educated because all of this information is public. Most of us wouldn't know near as much if all this information wasn't public. And finally, there's a public awareness system, public awareness property where you actually know that security is a big problem. One of the things the government's trying to do is pretend that there's no security problems. Everything's quiet. There's no security problems in the country. Ignore that little bomb over there. Another effect of this is companies' reputations are harmed by public disclosure. So it does encourage changes. But this harm is not a whole lot, so it's not going to encourage as much change as we would like. And finally, there might be an increase in software quality over time. If we keep finding these bugs and fixing them, in theory, the software should get better, right? Well, Eric Rescorla did an interesting study last year, and he came up with the answer, no, not really. He spent a lot of time trying to analyze patterns of bugs over time to see if was there a decrease in bugs after 10 years of studying it, things like that. And no matter what he did, he could not find any kind of noticeable decrease in the number of bugs for any given piece of software over time, or even across types of software. Operating systems in general didn't get more secure over time either. So this argument is being made less and less because all the current data says that it's not true. Software is not actually getting better over time. So another interesting thing is, if I'm a vendor, how do I prove that I have a secure system? And one of the ideas that came from a man named Stuart Schechter at Harvard is, let's pay for vulnerabilities. So I'm a company, I make some kind of piece of software. I want to prove to you that it's secure. So what I can do is I'll give out money to anyone who finds a vulnerability. And I'll do it through some kind of trusted third party so you know you're going to get the money if you find it. You report the vulnerability, you get $500. And what can happen is, once it's not collected, you can start increasing the value of it. So, no one collected the $500 last month. So this month, I'll give anyone $750 if they collect it. Sooner or later, it's going to be worth it to start looking through the code and finding vulnerabilities. And the claim that's made, a reward of X dollars means that the software can be used to protect at least X dollars worth of information. And the reason behind this is, if I'm a hacker, I discover some new vulnerability in some system. There's a reward out there for $20,000 if I report it, or I can hack some system and get something that's worth $5,000. Which one would I do? I'm going to go report it. I'm going to take the legitimate route with no risk and get more money. Many people would do both. Well, the argument is you've got to time it right, because as soon as you report it, they're going to fix the problem. So, and you can also put some kind of delayed claim in the money saying, if it's exploited right after you report it, then you don't get the money. So there have been ideas of how to get around that, but that's definitely an issue with this. A bigger issue is protect X dollars worth of information in total cost everyone using the product. So if 10 people use the product, I might, hacking one person individually isn't better than reporting it. However, hacking all 10 might be. So this is the total amount of all information protected by your firewall product or something like that. And if you know anything, you'll realize this is not very strong because you're never going to pay more for security than what it's protecting. So it means you can never pay out, the security company that's making the product could never pay out a reward to protect that would cover everything that everyone's using it for. That's just never going to happen unless they're willing to give away money, and not many people are. However, this system has very interesting uses as a comparative system. So what you do is, I'm a product, I'm making an operating system. For example, let's call it Linux, just because I don't know of an operating system by that name. So if I'm making Linux and I want to prove it's secure, I offer a nice big reward, $1,000 or something, for finding a vulnerability in my system. No one claims it because I'm a decent coder and I don't have many vulnerabilities. Or no one can find them because I'm a really bad coder and no one can read my code. One of the two. So then I offer a smaller reward for a similar claim in Microsoft's operating system. So I have a $1,000 reward on my software. I'll give $500 to anyone who can find a bug in Microsoft software. That's going to be claimed really quickly. So the argument there is it's easier to find a bug in Microsoft's system than it is mine, because if they could find one more easily in mine, they'd make more money by doing so. So why wouldn't they just go find it in mine? So using this way, you can end up comparing two security systems. And this is really useful, because it allows you to prove as a company that you have good security. And in general, it provides a metric for security. It's not really an absolute metric. It doesn't say, I am this secure. But it provides a comparative metric. It says, I'm more secure than all those products, but not those. Yes? Why?
Wouldn't the lawyers really just like this if Red Hat was going out and claiming, we'll give you $1,000 for every time you hack Microsoft? I think the lawyers would probably eat that one alive.
Not hack, just report a vulnerability.
Well, that's again, you take this from the pessimistic lawyer stance. That Corporation A encouraging somebody to deface or reverse engineer or go against
It has been tried in one or two places. It's very small. Sorry, what were you saying?
Between DMCA and the Patriot Act, they eat them alive, I would think. Because basically, Patriot Act makes it so that they can just stick in Guantanamo Bay.
Well, yes, as long as they can prove to you.
DMCA says that basically it makes that also legal for protection against reverse engineering.
Well, so those are extreme overgeneralizations. The DMCA has a number of exceptions, and no one has actually been prosecuted for reverse engineering of the DMCA yet for computer vulnerabilities.
Even though for everything else, reverse engineering is completely. So it's kind of flies in the face of that.
So the DMCA actually also only protects cryptography type systems. It doesn't protect uncryptographic systems. So looking through code is not covered by the DMCA, for example. And as far as I know, that is actually still legal. Many people do it daily. Look at full disclosure. You see a lot of people finding all kinds of vulnerabilities. And some of them might make money for it. So there might be an issue when if you're handing out money for attacks in the 800-pound gorilla, but that's probably not necessarily a legal problem as much as a slap lawsuit type problem, which is more. So there is that issue, and it's because of a problem in the law system, but there is that issue. So there's a number of other weaknesses there, though. First of all, employee tester collusion. So what happens if I'm making the software and I don't really like my company that much? I'll introduce a couple bugs and tell my friend, then he'll claim them. And we'll split the money. And we can keep doing this forever. So that's a big problem, this collusion. There's also tester-tester collusion. Since the money is increasing over time, if no one reports anything, if I find something and you find something, if we both find the same thing, instead of running to report it right away so we get the money, why don't we just talk to each other and just agree to wait for a little while until the money gets bigger, then split it. So you have lots of collusion problems. There's a will people participate problem. Many hackers don't do it for the money. They hack because it's fun. They hack for all kinds of other reasons. So you're going to get a lot of people who, even though it might be more worthwhile monetarily to go and report the vulnerability, they're still not. So how many people would actually participate in this? So there's another one, making vulnerabilities public harms reputation. Why would I pay people to harm my reputation? There's a big issue there. So the trick is the reputation boost from saying, no one has claimed my $1,000 vulnerability reward has to be better than any public harm that comes from actually reporting it. And you get a loss of free testing. There's lots of people looking for vulnerabilities right now in people's software for free. No one's paying them, they're just doing it. If you start offering money for anyone who finds vulnerabilities, no one's going to do it for free. They're going to want the money. So you're going to get a lot of free testing that's going down the drain because people aren't going to do it anymore. So these are some major weaknesses of this idea. But it's a really interesting idea because it's also the first good metric for security that I've seen of how do you measure and compare security systems objectively. So next I'm going to move into digital rights management, which has already been brought up a little bit. Digital rights management has a lot of interesting issues. And in particular, the one I'm going to talk about right now is how do you get people to actually use DRM? If you're a company, how would you get people to use DRM and what are the implications of that? And to understand this, you need to understand a concept of economics called network effects. So everyone here is probably familiar with Metcalfe's law. The number of connections in a network is on roughly order n squared of the number of nodes in the network. And then we have the concept of a positive externality, which is the opposite of what we saw before, that the value of the good increases with the number of users with that good. So imagine the telephone system. The first guy, the telephone system's useless. The more people that get on it, the better, the more useful that telephone is. So this is a positive externality. When you combine the two, you get network effects. Larger networks have much more value than small networks, and it grows very fast. So, and networks of this type have a lot of interesting properties. First of all is the critical mass property, which means until it gets so big, it's going to be really hard to convince anyone to use it. This is the classic, who bought the first telephone problem? Who bought the first fax machine? Until you get enough people around you using them, it's completely worthless to you. If no one you talk to has a cell phone, then why do you have a cell phone? Cell phones are not as strong, but yes. Winner take all. In general, in these kind of markets, you see a winner take all. A classic example is the VHS versus beta. Only one of those systems can really survive. So when both of them existed, whichever one ended up with the stronger network is the one that won, and beta virtually doesn't exist anymore. So you see the strong dichotomy, and you can only see one telephone system. You can only see one type of VCR. And when these network effects really matter, there's a strong feedback cycle that causes a winner take all. There's also a very strong first mover advantage. Where if you get out there first and you have the network to start with, it's really hard for anyone to come in and get people away from you, because why would I join so-and-so's other telephone network that's not connected when I've got all these people I can talk to here? And the implication of this is that history can determine the market structure. Whoever moved first is the technology that's going to exist, not whoever's better. And that can be a problem. So how do these apply to DRM? So consider two different platforms. You have the trusted DRM platform, where all your music is trusted and such, and you have some kind of public platform. This is the current internet. This is darknets, if you've heard about those. And the main distinction between these two is moving content back and forth between the two networks. It's really costly to move content from the trusted to the public network. We're going to assume we can break DRM because no one's proven us wrong. So, however, it's not easy. It's not easy to break all these new DRM systems. So it's fairly costly to move something from the trusted network, from a DRM system, to the public internet. However, it's trivially cheap to move it from the public internet to the trusted network, meaning all the trusted media players play on DRM music. So it's really easy. It just automatically works, essentially. But it's really hard to move it the other direction. So you look at people's decisions to adopt which platform. So do I want to get a media player that only plays public stuff? Or do you want to get a media player that plays the trusted stuff also at the expense of, I know we have to pay out the ass from music and things like that. So when I'm thinking about this, what kind of things are going into my mind? kind of information I need, the size of each network. If there's a lot of people that buying trusted systems, then I'm going to want to use it because there's going to be a lot of content there and things like that. If almost no one's buying a trusted system, why would I? So this is the network effects. There's the cost of using the platform. The public internet already exists. It's cheap. Using a trusted system is going to mean I have to pay a lot more. Music from iTunes is a lot more expensive than music from Napster, for example, or from news groups or from the underground or whatever. The prices of the goods on the platform and the cost of this cost of moving across platforms, all those are going to go into my decision of whether I want to which platform I'm going to choose. And it turns out there's a lot of interesting implications that came from thinking of it this way. First of all, the large public existing network makes it very attractive. So it's going to be very hard to get DRM systems in because the public internet already has this first mover advantage. The internet exists. It's going to be really hard to convince people not to transfer their music around the internet and only use the DRM systems when all of it's available there. And this effectively unidirectional copying incentivizes the adoption of the trusted network. Since it's really easy to get music from the public internet to a trusted system, but hard to go the opposite direction, that's going to make people want to use the trusted network. So it's really not clear whether the trusted systems can exist or not. However, there's a really interesting implication for content. Widely popular content, Britney Spears, things like that, that's almost certainly going to be broken. If you can make a lot of money or a lot of people like it, then it's going to be worthwhile for you to break it. So there's all kinds of reasons why it's going to be worthwhile for you to break it. However, the low-demand stuff, the stuff that you and I put together that maybe 10 people in the world like, but they really like it, that's not going to be broken because why would any of my 10 people, they're willing to pay the money, they really like the music, why would they break the system? There's not a whole lot of demand. So the implication of this is the success of the trusted platforms is not going to depend on whether people like Britney Spears use it. Their stuff's going to be broken. It's going to depend on whether the low guys, the you and I that make random music out of our home, if we use the trusted system, that's going to help the adoption of the trusted platform much more than any of the popular music using it. And that's a really interesting implication I thought that I hadn't thought of before. And this is my last slide. So this is, in summary, this is just a lot of the current thinking around the economics of security. And I'm open for questions if anyone has any. Yes.
I have to apologize. I was late coming in. So I'm going to ask something that applies to this that may not have come straight from your presentation. Why is IPv6 not being implemented, even though we've had it for a while, from an economic perspective?
It's largely the same network effects problem. Everyone's using IPv4. And so a competing system is very hard to get in because why would anyone switch off IPv4? It works for them. Not many people are using IPv6. Until you get a critical mass there, it's going to be very hard to move. And that's because the value of the network grows with the size of the network, and the network for IPv6 is small, so this has got a very small value for moving over to it. If everyone used it and there was a lot of extra value from using it for each individual person, then they would move. But there's not, so no one individually is moving. And when no one individually wants to move, then as a collective, no one moves. Yes?
Going back to your slide about paying out rewards for vulnerabilities, for finding vulnerabilities, Rich and I have made a lot of comments about the idea that offering rewards is like having those quote-unquote hacking contests for things like, can you break this grid hybrid? I was just wondering if you could comment on his criticisms about those as they apply to sort of paying out the rewards for vulnerabilities.
I can. Well, first of all, the question was, Bruce Nyer has a very low opinion of like hacking contests and other things. Oh, look, my secure. I offered $20 million and no one broke it. He is very critical of that. And this is very similar to exactly what he's very critical of. And how does that result? This is a little bit different in that it's more serious. It's not the one company. So all the snake oil companies, they offer a $20 million reward. if you broke their system, do you think they would ever have $20 million to pay you? No. That's one of the reasons that the proposal includes using a trusted third party. You put the money, you give it to a third party, you guarantee that it exists and you're going to get paid. So you give it to someone like a bank whose reputation depends on being trusted. Things like that. So that's one way of getting around that. An interesting side note is the person who did this research, a man named Stuart Schechter, who was at Harvard at the time, Bruce Schneier was on his committee for his PhD, which was this research. So I'm sure he gave him a hell of a time. And you can see that in this, because a lot of this is not the standard one-off. It's a repeated system. So every time it gets broken, you put the money back up again and back up again. It's not a one-time system. And you start low, and you keep going and increasing until you find the right point. So, and you that way, it's not this one-off system. And it turns out that this has a lot of properties that are much more beneficial and are less likely, that are more likely to encourage innovation. So paying $100 for a vulnerability that I happen to have found, that's more likely to happen. They have $100, I'm pretty sure. And they can be nice to give it to me to tell them about the vulnerability. So there's a lot of things like that that have been built into the system to try to avoid exactly the problems that Bruce talks about. Any other questions? I think I'm running out of time anyway, so thank you very much.